This is an ABC podcast.
No ear in Māori and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, I was reminded today it's the start of a new month. It's the 1st of May. Hopefully it's going well for you. Today on the show, we've got the Palm Scheme. It seems like it's no longer fit for purpose. Also, Vanuatu's upcoming referendum highlights its political instability. And the saga continues with Kiribati's judiciary system. More on those stories shortly. And remember, once our show is done, you can find our top stories by simply typing in Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. And you can like and follow us on Facebook and Instagram via ABC Pacific. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoll, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Typically, the autumn months, it's a boom time for Pacific seasonal workers as the agricultural sector amps up recruitment for the winter harvest. But this year, demand is down and experts worry an upcoming mandate to force farmers to pay palm workers a minimum of 30 hours per week is making them look elsewhere for labour. Now, Pacific recruiters are sounding the alarm as Carl Evans reports.
For Pacific Labour Mobility recruiter Dan Dempsey, the best part of his job is helping Ni Vanuatu people with no income get farm work in Australia. But lately, his job has become increasingly difficult because demand for Pacific seasonal workers is dropping.
There is a lot of angst. I'm a member of the Vanuatu Agents Committee over here, and we're all experiencing this. We're all experiencing massive downturn in numbers. I would say most of my day is spent counselling workers who now no longer have a job.
Dan works for Empower SWR Vanuatu. He says traditionally, demand for Pacific agricultural workers increases in February as farmers load up for the winter harvest. But this year, he says recruiters are detecting a 20 to 40% drop in demand, and he fears it's due to the upcoming employment changes, which will see farmers forced to offer palm workers a minimum of 30 hours per week. And with current palm contracts set at 9 months, he worries the costs are now too much for employers to bear.
Farmers are not prepared to commit to paying. Plus, you've also got what's called the 20-hour rule. So that's where a grower has to pay for their transport and accommodation, plus the 30 hours, in a week where they're working less than 20 hours per week. That translates to around about over $1,000 for, say, for a 30-hour week per worker that farmer has to cough up for. And that is turning out to be a huge turn-off for a grower.
Data from a new study appears to agree with him. According to Richard Curtin, a research associate at the Development Policy Centre, demand for palm workers has declined 10% over 9 months prior to February of this year. That's a drop in almost 3,000 workers.
When you then talked about the 10% decline, that refers to the short-term workers, but we've also got data there including the workers who are also in agriculture, but they're long-term. There's a small portion who fit into that category, but surprisingly, they've declined even greater. So the significance of that is that there's something happening in agriculture that's causing approved employers to lower their demand for both sorts of workers. And we think that's due to the new deed of agreement.
He's referring to the new 30-hour rule, which will come into effect in July. However, that might not be the only thing turning farmers away from Pacific workers. Richard says the number of backpackers in Australia has returned to pre-pandemic levels, and they are proving to be a cheaper option for farmers.
Backpackers are much more flexible source of workers for the employers because they are employed strictly on a casual basis, which means that each day they're employed, it's only for that day and only get ongoing work if they're requested to come back the next day. And so that flexibility is appealing, whereas the seasonal workers are on a contract.
Interestingly, the drop in demand for Pacific workers looks specific to the agricultural sector and is not occurring in others, such as the meat industry. Regardless, Dan fears between 4,000 and 5,000 Ni Vanuatu workers could be made unemployed this season if the trend continues. He says that would be devastating for some families.
For these workers, this is their career. Many workers come back to Vanuatu. First thing they do is they take their money, they use it as collateral for loans to pay for land and for to build houses. So effectively taking a mortgage. They use the collateral and the guarantee that they have work coming up, like that they are in employment, to get the loan approval. And now they're finding that they're piling into my office to say, Dan, I really have to go back to Australia as quickly as possible. So at the end of the day, at the ground level here, we have a lot of workers that are going to have their land and house repossessed.
And that's Pacific Labour Mobility recruiter Dan Dempsey ending that report from Kyle Evans. Meanwhile, we asked the Australian government if they were concerned with the decline in numbers. A departmental spokesperson said the 30-hour changes were implemented following concerns that workers, when offered too few hours, could not earn enough to support themselves in Australia. Now, the spokesperson said while numbers have moderated since the pandemic, participation in the PALM scheme remains high.
Pacific Beat.
Well, horticultural industry group Australian Fresh Produce Alliance says the changes to minimum working hours are the main reason behind the drop in seasonal worker demand. Chief Executive Claire McLennan says farmers want to employ Pacific workers as they're more skilled and productive than backpackers. But she tells Doug Dingwall the lack of flexibility under the new rules means the PALM scheme is no longer fit for purpose.
In a horticulture context, that's a real challenge because obviously we have seasonal fluctuations in production and even a couple of days of rain or particularly cold weather mean a really significant delay to work on a farm. And that lack of flexibility actually means that the PALM schemes no longer fit to purpose for highly seasonal work, and it poses a really significant financial risk to employers. So a really key reason why that reduction's occurred is that those GN guidelines have some components that are really unworkable for employers. Probably the second component is there's definitely been an increase in backpackers returning to Australia post-COVID, and obviously as the PALM scheme has become less and less flexible and more difficult to operate for employers, it becomes much more attractive to employ backpackers who inherently have much greater flexibility in how they could be employed on farm.
What's more attractive about the backpackers compared to seasonal workers, according to the feedback you're receiving at the moment?
I think the real attractiveness of the backpackers is the ability to engage backpackers in short-term working relationships that really complement both the seasonality of work in horticulture, but also workers that are typically able to more easily, you know, move between different blocks of work, which is something that doesn't really occur in the PALM scheme. Having said that, the real challenge for industry is the PALM scheme is really well supported by employers, and particularly employers in horticulture, and the productivity of PALM scheme workers we know is greater than backpackers, and typically they return to work year on year on farm. So it's actually a real challenge for industry because there's arguably a strong preference to employ PALM workers because of that increase in productivity, but it's really limited now by the lack of flexibility within the new program.
Is there a need to do some tweaking to the new requirements for employers, or do you think they need to be scrapped altogether?
So without getting too technical, there's a current set of arrangements that are operating within the PALM scheme now that see workers guaranteed effectively 120 hours work over 4 weeks. That's an average of 30 hours per week. Now, industry's view is that that's something that's totally achievable. We can meet that requirement. We can make sure that workers have that minimum work and the earnings associated with that and the protection of that minimum work guarantee. The challenge is from July this year, we'll move to a fixed 30-hour requirement per week. We've really been encouraging government to lower a significant reduction in workers and obviously the increase in backpackers, so an availability of an alternative workforce. We've really been encouraging government to review the current settings and stick with the settings that we have now, and that is those hours averaged over a month, because we feel that meets obviously the requirements of workers for a secure and guaranteed income minimum amount of work, but also meet the flexibility needs of our industry.
And that's Chief Executive of Australian Fresh Produce Alliance, Claire McLennan, speaking to Doug Dingwall. And Pacific Beat has approached Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, for a comment.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, early in the week, we brought you the story on the upcoming referendum in Vanuatu, where overseas polling stations in Australia, New Zealand and Fiji are on track for Vanuatu citizens to cast their vote on May 29th. The aim of the referendum is to address the problem of political instability, which has been caused by members of parliament switching their party allegiances. But former Prime Minister Ismail Kausakau is not happy with the change and wants the upcoming referendum deferred to next year so the public can have their say. So joining us this morning to explain more on this matter is Vanuatu's former Prime Minister and Leader in Opposition, Ismail Kausakau. With that, I say welcome to the show, Olsen Wanam.
Thank you. Good morning to you all.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. As we get straight into it, I mean, why are you really wanting the referendum to be delayed till next year? Because, you know, at this moment, it looks like it's just still going to go ahead.
Yes, I believe the government is adamant that it should proceed. It isn't that I'm against it. It's just that I've been touring some of the islands and I've even been to New Zealand and even around my constituency in Port Vila, and people are just not really appreciated of the fact that there is a prospect on the 29th of May that their fundamental rights under the Constitution will be restricted by those amendments.
Mm. So what in the referendum is it actually asking the community to vote on? Because that possibly, I know there's two amendments, but is that what the community are not fully aware of?
Well, the first is in relation to membership of political parties. If a person is elected to Parliament as a member of a political party, that is where he must stay and remain until the next elections. And if he was intent upon throughout that period citing a motion against the government in power or in which he's a member or against his or her president, then that person should have his seat vacated and it is returned to the citizens to vote for a new candidate. It is premised on the foundation that it'll keep members of parliament grounded, and that they must follow the structure within their political parties, and not be able to be able to express views contrary to the leadership that they belong to. And if you agree to that proposition, then obviously you're voting yes to restrict your rights so that it will enable that stability to last up to the next elections. Now, the second amendment is in relation to independent members of parliament who must affiliate with an existing political party the minute they get into parliament and remain in that affiliation until the end of the 4 years and be prohibited from exercising any right to express frustration in the regime of that political party who could be the next prime minister. And if they do so, within that 2 year period, the 4 year period, they lose the seats.
Mm. Mr. Kausakau, let's sort of maybe get into that a little bit more, because a lot of this is political instability. Countless times we've seen, you know, change of leadership in prime ministerial roles, and they say these law changes will bring in a new era of political stability. Fair assessment?
Well, we've received advice from the State Law Office to the contrary, and a lot of these leaders are approaching citizens notifying them that the amendments won't stop instability, but it's sensible direction in their view towards making sure that members of parliament stay grounded. But my view is to enable people to appreciate why these amendments are taking place. Is it just members of parliament inside parliament? And if that is the case, why is it affecting the rights of citizens? Are there any other avenues available to people to look at before we contemplate a restriction of fundamental rights under the Constitution? Or what is it? What is the actual root cause of instability? If you look at our history back from 1983, 87, 91, 95 up to today, it's all about power struggles. If you're a president of a political party, you can become the next prime minister. There is no end of a person being a president of a political party and no end to a person being a prime minister. And this is the what's causing the friction that's enabling leaders and members of parliament like to have recourse to their rights under the Constitution. And I've been walking around my constituency and the proposal is, well, why don't we deal with those issues first before we look at tampering with our rights under the Constitution. And it's, for me, it's a fair comment. And that's why I'm suggesting that the Electoral Commission should be visiting people, explaining to them what these amendments entail, and listen to their views. And because it is a referendum, it isn't something that will be revisited in a period of 4 years, that it needs to be dealt with quite meticulously and in such a way that has an appreciation that people are restricting their fundamental rights under the Constitution for a real purpose and not just motivations that are instigated by politics itself.
Yeah, well, I mean, these reforms were passed, you know, in Parliament back in December 2023. Do you think they just were drafted up too quickly without proper consultation?
Well, consultation previously, after 1980, was, you know, getting a group of people in a room in Port Vila somewhere or in Santo and identifying them as members of civil society and getting their views and then having a bill traversed to Parliament. Well, this is, you know, it's all fair and well if you're dealing with a normal bill or an act of Parliament. But when it comes to a referendum under the Constitution, the last time there was a referendum in New Hebrides was prior to 1980, where, you know, you had public servants, teachers, police officers visiting all the Nakamals and the Nasaras around Vanuatu, explaining to them what people would be expecting out of this freedom. And everybody understood what was before them. That's why the majority of the population opted for independence. Now, let's not rush this one. Let's if a referendum in, you know, some of these countries, the last one in Australia was about 2 years. The one in Bougainville was 4 years. The New Caledonian question was in excess of 11 years. Preparation. Why are we rushing to an amendment of the Constitution that will deal with a restriction of rights that have been conferred on people as a result of the country becoming independent? And it was a requirement by the United Nations Committee of 24 on Independence that Vanuatu had to have that code and Bill of Rights in the Constitution intact as a condition or prerequisite to becoming independent. So now, 44 years later, we could be accused of tampering with those rights negatively against the citizens in a matter that concerns just members of parliament frolicking in parliament in a manner that could be resolved by other means.
Thank you for that. If you've just tuned in, we're speaking to Vanuatu's former Prime Minister Ishmael Kasakau on the upcoming referendum. It is set for May 29th. Mr. Kasakau, you sit in the opposition. There have been reports of people really asking, who is the actual opposition leader right now? Because there seems to be even a block of MPs appearing that they may want to get even Gracias Cedric as opposition leader. What are your thoughts on this?
Yes, well, I mean, we're not adverse to any attempt to have a change in the leadership in the opposition. Of course, none of us wanted this job. I went into the opposition at a time where everybody was running into government and the positions were had become vacant. So we assumed those positions. We were working as a current opposition group. Now there's a group that's just come into the opposition claiming they represent the majority. Some of those members of parliament are still inclusive of Gracias Cedric, still driving around in government vehicles. They've got people working in government as part of the coalition arrangements. And, you first of all, you can't have one foot in the government and one foot in the opposition. And secondly, do it properly. Approach, have a meeting called and have a vote taken. And we can see in who will be the popular leader. And, of course, the state law office is advised on that process. And it was just ignored. So this is why I've suggested in the past that, let's wait for it. But, in fact, I inform you that as of last evening, I've already resigned as the opposition leader. I'm not going to be involved in any struggle for leadership. If somebody else thinks they can do a better job, then let them try. And I've made the seat available for them to occupy as of this morning onwards. Let's see if they can do a better job than we can. And, good on them if they can, but let's do everything properly.
Well, I have to ask then, is there someone that you are thinking would be suitable for that position then?
Just anyone that the members of the opposition elect to become the next leader, in view of the fact that I've just resigned.
Now, I have to ask, Mr. Kasakau, as we wrap up, we do realise, if there's anyone who wants to see stability, within the government, is your community. If you're still going to be an MP, what are the current or urgent issues that need to be addressed, though?
Well, I mean, the question is, what's going to be achieved by these amendments? The proposition is to keep individual members of parliament grounded, but the question is where in Vanuatu history has an independent person through their movement become the next prime minister after a bout of instability? So what we also need to address is what happens to presidents who send their members to sign motions of no confidences, and then just to gain an advantage to negotiate for the next leadership. Where does that leave the people? Because what we will be seeing is the game remains the game remains the same, but only that the party's changed. So what do you do in those circumstances?
I do have to ask, is there a message, though, as you step away from that position, what is your message moving forward?
Well, I mean, the question that for me that is of more import than the constitutional amendment is will the people be served at all? And how can How can we get to a situation where we can hold members of parliament accountable to their voters throughout a four-year period instead of just waiting for the end of 4 years for people to... Because we, you know, we come from a fragmented country where 80% of the population is still, you know, they have, they lack the normal savvy to identify between who's a good member of parliament or not. So how can we come up with checks on members of parliament to keep them responsible and accountable to their voters? And for me, that is of more importance than the issues that are the subject of this referendum.
Absolutely. Well, Mr. Kausakau, we hope those things do get implemented, and we appreciate your time this morning.
Much appreciated. Have a nice day.
No worries. That, of course, is Vanuatu's former Prime Minister, Ishmael Kausakau, here on Pacific Beat. Stay tuned, because up next, it's your news wrap with producer Mackenzie Smith. And welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. It is that time. Yes, we head around the region to find out the latest headlines with our news wrap brought to you by producer Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say, morena.
Morning, Aggie.
Yeah, look, to Fiji first, where police say young children are being caught up in drug trafficking.
Yeah, so these comments came from the Assistant Commissioner of Police Internal Affairs in Fiji, Sakio Ganivatu, who says drug dealers are preying on young children. Fiji Village reports him saying that he recently met two children aged 8 and 9 who were selling needles in Suva, while other school children have been found by police selling drugs to their peers. Ganivatu says this should be a wake-up call for parents. And as recently as January, Fiji reported a 94% increase in drug-related criminal cases year on year.
Wow, that is crazy. We stay in Fiji, though, because the government has signed a series of agreements with Australia. What do these include?
Yeah, so this comes off the back of a visit to Fiji by Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, who met with Fiji's Prime Minister Sitiveti Rambuka on Tuesday. The pair signed several agreements, including Australia giving infrastructure and cyber security support to Fiji, and Rambuka welcomed Australia's commitment to quadruple the number of Australia Award Pacific scholarships offered each year to Fijian students. That's increasing to 50 students from next year.
Nice. And there's also concern among Pacific civil society groups over France's proposed constitutional changes in New Caledonia. What's happening there?
Yeah, so for context, France's Senate in April passed electoral amendments which would make it easier for French citizens who have migrated to New Caledonia after 1998 to vote in its elections. But critics say these measures could dampen the political representation of the indigenous Kanak people there. Now, the Pacific Regional Non-Governmental Organizations Alliance, which represents some 15 civil society groups in the region, says in a statement that if Parliament signs the amendments into law, it could violate the UN Charter and its Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. France's Parliament will consider the amendment on May 13.
Nice. Mackenzie, thank you so much for bringing the headlines from across the region. Always a lot happening in the Pacific. Appreciate it.
No worries.
That is Mackenzie Smith with our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kia ora na and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl. We switch our attention to Kiribati. The anti-corruption groups and international bodies are extremely worried about their judiciary after the government moved to expel High Court Judge David Lambourne. It will be in the culmination of a saga that began 2 years ago when the president suspended Justice Lambourne on allegations of misconduct, sparking a judicial crisis that has left the Pacific Island nation without any senior judges. Dubravka Volodia reports.
21 days. That's what Australian David Lambourne has been given to leave the country he's lived in for many years. He's been handed a deportation notice after the country's parliament last week voted in favour of his removal from the High Court. Kiribati opposition MP Sir Yeremia Tabai says it's unacceptable.
We're very disappointed by the action taken by government. There was no real basis at all, you know, for the decision was taken. It's all political.
Justice Lambourne is married to the current opposition leader, Tessie Lambourne. The government responded to his legal battle against his suspension by suspending the Chief Justice and the three judges of the Court of Appeal, all of them foreigners. Mr. Tabai is calling on its Pacific neighbours to help address the issue.
What we need to, you know, to ask is for our neighbours in the region to express a view on what is happening now.
International reaction has been strong. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers, Margaret Sethwaite, has criticised the government's moves on the judiciary. In a statement, she says Justice Lambourne's imminent deportation is a major setback for the country.
Judge Lambourne was removed after proceedings that violated international standards. He was not allowed to have a fair hearing after almost 4 years of proceedings that have undermined the independence of the judiciary in Kiribati.
The vote in Parliament followed the tabling of a report by a tribunal set up by the government to investigate allegations of misconduct. Of the five allegations against Justice Lambourne, the tribunal found only one constituted a breach of the Judicial Code of Conduct. That breach related to a delay in handing down a written judgment in a case where he had already delivered a verbal judgment. Transparency International Australia CEO Clancy Moore says the move is at odds with judicial independence that is mandated in Kiribati's constitution.
These latest developments are very concerning from a governance and democracy perspective, in that you have a very senior judge with allegations of a politically motivated attack on him being asked to leave the country. This raises questions around the independence of the political system in Kiribati and also the importance of the principle of separation of powers as well.
Kiribati will have an election soon, and Mr. Moore says it could have not come at a worse time.
This is potentially a significant blow on the working of Kiribati's democracy and comes at a time where the country is also facing elections soon as well. And of course, the overlay of increasing geopolitical competition in the Pacific between China, the US and allies like Australia as well.
But others disagree. University of Canberra's Faculty of Business, Government and Law, Adjunct Assistant Professor Dr. Bal Karma, says the issue needs to be seen in a Pacific context.
The government decision is not right or is not wrong, but the government decision to remove the judge in the context of the situation, politically, the judge be seen as politically connected due to the opposition leader being the spouse, that context itself makes the judge's continuing tenure untenable, in that not only would the government undermine his independence, which is critical to any judge, but the public would certainly also undermine his independence.
But he says Justice Lambourne should be allowed to stay in his chosen home.
His ongoing role in the development of Kiribati as a country is still vital. So I think one of the ways that this issue can be resolved
is placing Justice Lemburn on cases that doesn't concern the government. So there are other cases, civil matters between individuals and things like that.
Justice Lemburn has the right to appeal the government's deportation notice. Pacific Beat has contacted the Kiribati government for comment.
And that is Dubravka Volodia reporting.
Are you wanting to break your betel nut addiction, zumba your way to a fitter you, or get on top of that excruciating case of gout? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has you covered. Pacific Pulse seeks out experts, movers and shakers, and aunties and uncles from across our region to bust open our health issues, challenge taboos, and separate fact from fiction. Join host Melissa Macon on Pacific Pulse Wednesday at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
You're tuning in to Pacific Beat with your host, Aggie Dubol. Meat lovers in Papua New Guinea will soon be enjoying juicy lamb chops if a private food distribution company and the PNG Department of Agriculture and Livestock have anything to do with it. A sheep breeding and farming project is underway in the cool climate of Sagiri Hills outside of the capital, Port Moresby, where hundreds of sheep are being raised for market. Reports from PNG say the initiative taken by BNG Trading, which has been operating in PNG for the past 100 years, is to help improve food security for people. Meat prices are very expensive in PNG, and it is hoped that this venture will bring another source of protein for consumers. Ralph Yumble is Livestock Advisor for the Department of Agriculture and Livestock in PNG's Northern Region, and is speaking with Caroline Terriman.
My department, the Department of Agriculture and Livestock in the country, it plays an overarching role in the development of the agriculture sector. Okay, one of it is the livestock sector. Unfortunately, the livestock sector did not get off the ground since independence. So the department is concerned about it, and it is vying and willing to go deeper in that area in developing livestock because of the food security reason that the country faces. Okay, the department plans that raising animal for meat is important because, of course, the nutrition aspect of things, but we don't do it as such at this stage. The tree crop sector has taken off, especially in cocoa and coconut. And currently the balsa industry is another tree crop, especially in East New Britain, where the price of balsa has rocketed and everybody is turning cocoa land into balsa production. So the livestock is left behind. And the government's plan was that it has to look around for development partners to help in the development of livestock in the country. Especially in the avian section, we have an igni table bird, the zinag. They all are interested in producing protein, and they are rearing chicken for local market. It is a big industry, but for the ruminants, there's nothing so much going on in the country.
So are you talking about cows here?
The private sector has taken the lead, in fact. Places like Numondo in West New Britain, where the New Britain Farm Oil is home to, what they do is they grow oil palm, they get the oil out of it, and then the meal runs are given to the animals to fatten the animals up. The meat industry generally does include sheep, chicken, and cows.
So as we speak, the meat industry is still small, is it?
It is small, but the private sector has taken the lead. When you look at the oil palm industry, they're based in West New Britain. They're based in Moresby now, especially in the Markham Valley. They are feeding the animals in feedlot. It doesn't need much land, but it is producing good beef. They're tasty. They're really good beef, international standard.
These sheep that are being farmed in the Sagiri Plateau, is that a part of this effort to increase meat production in Papua New Guinea?
Very correct. If you look at the Department of Agriculture and Livestock, we support such a venture because it helps to increase meat production in Papua New Guinea. Not so much on the larger ruminant, but on smaller ruminants.
Why is it important that this sheep is going to be in the market?
Traditionally, Papua New Guineans, they love the pig meat and other meat. And they didn't know land flats until they were introduced maybe after the independence. When they found out that it's a bit fatty and it would go well with local vegetables, people start buying land flats because it was cheap. Other meat cuts were expensive. So they started buying lots and lots of land flaps. So the market opened up for land flaps. And that's when the people in New Zealand and Australia saw the opportunity to bring land flaps into our country. And BNG, being in the country, I should say it's more like a local company. It has been in this country for over 100 years. So when they saw that Papua New Guineans love their land flaps, I guess the managing director of the company said, hey, listen, why can't we grow sheep in Papua New Guinea? So he took the initiative, did their mathematics, and then they decided to bring in the sheep called Meatmaster from Australia into PNG. Just a brief background of the breed Meatmaster. It originated from somewhere in Saudi Arabia. I think it is known as Dopa. It was brought to Fiji, and after keeping it in Fiji, breeding it, and they call it the Fiji Fantastic. And from there, it went to Australia again. And from Australia, now it's here in Papua New Guinea. So we are hoping that the project I'm working with, PX3 project up in the Sogeri Plateau, when we get our first lamb on the ground, we will call it Toya Kina. The reason for that name is Toya is small in value in PNG. So we said, okay, let's start small. So we call it a Toya. And then as we go along, of course, we'll make money from the lamb meat. So we will be calling it Toya Kina. So our breed here in the Sogeri Plateau will be called Toya Kina, and we wanted September 16 we should have some dropping, and we will call them the independent lamb.
What about the good meat? Will that be also a product that will come out from these sheep?
That's right. We were talking about the lamb flaps, so I decided to zero in on lamb flaps. But yes, there'll be other cuts, lamb loins, and other cuts also put in the market. So I guess when we do that, we will support the meat industry one way or the other.
Meat anyway is very expensive.
Oh, talking about the ram steak, yes. We're aiming that it will help reduce malnutrition in the country when there's readily available protein source all around.
And that was Ralph Yambu speaking to our Caroline Turman with that report. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. It's time to take a look back at our main stories today. Demand for seasonal workers in Australia is experiencing a downturn of up to 40%, and recruiter Dan Dempsey is sounding the alarm.
There is a lot of angst. I'm a member of the Vanuatu Agents Committee over here, and we're all experiencing this. We're all experiencing massive downturn in numbers. I would say most of my day is spent counselling workers who now no longer have a job.
And we also spoke to Ishmael Kalsakal. He mentioned today on our show that he is stepping down as the leader of the opposition party there in Vanuatu. Find these stories as you type Pacific Beat and Radio Australia in your search engine. We'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us this afternoon at 5 p.m. Stay tuned, it's news next, but coming up after that, it's Leisure Daily. Until then, o tō awhātou, I'm Aggie Dubow, and this is Pacific Beat.